Well, good morning. We're going to be starting in Exodus chapter 15 today, if you want to turn on over there. Last time we were in chapter 14 and we saw the account of the great miracle that God did in parting the sea and bringing his people through on dry land. And, you know, by God's direction, being led by the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, and God's own words of direction, he told them to turn and to head south, and the Israelites camped next to the Gulf of Aqaba. So here they are camped on the beach. They're facing the way from which they had come, which was toward the west, looking toward the Wadi of Atur that they have come down, and it's narrow and boxed in, and it really leaves them trapped on the beach, except for if they wanted to exit through that wadi, which is just a narrow canyon valley. And they look and they see Pharaoh and all of his military might coming down through that wadi and are approaching them. So let's just do it from our memory a little bit. How did the Israelites react when they saw the armies of Egypt with Pharaoh leading them? Yeah, they started with something else first. Not what they said, but how they felt. Fear. They were very afraid. And so they looked, and then they turned to Moses, and they blame him. Why did you bring us here? Now, it's easy for us to look at the story and miss some of the details from time to time. Did Moses actually take them here? It's kind of yes and no, but it wasn't because Moses said this was the place to be. How were they led there? Pillar of fire, pillar of cloud. But they're looking at Moses going, what did you bring us here for? And they have some interesting wording. Were there not enough graves in Egypt? Do we have to come out here to die and get buried? They also say to Moses, what'd you butt in for? We told you to leave us alone. We would rather just serve Pharaoh in his time and just stay there and not be out here on this kind of a mess. So what is Moses' response to the people?
Fear not, trust in the Lord.
Yeah, and he gives them some specific directions. You remember? Watch and see what God's going to do when you are
faithful.
Silent. Kind of a nice way of saying, shut up and watch. You're going to see the power of God expended on your behalf. And so that's his basic plan for them. Be quiet, watch what God's going to do. So what did God say to Moses? Well, not quite yet. That's coming. What? Yeah, what do you complain for? And what did he tell him to do? Get going. Well, forward. Go forward. Well, where's forward? You know, into the water. And so then God tells Moses, stretch out your staff, the one that we did the miracles with when I saw you at the burning bush, and then the one you did the miracles with that was your prop, if you will. Was it the staff that had power? No, it was God. But it was the prop that God used to demonstrate Moses' power in front of Pharaoh and his henchmen. So stretch out your staff over the water. And he did. Now, where have the pillar of fire and pillar of cloud gone? Where are they at?
Behind them,
which means back, blocking the way for the Egyptians to move forward to the beach. They've got fog and fire right there. They can't really see, but the fire is illuminating the way for the Israelites. And so when he puts out his staff, the water is piled up and the Israelites cross on dry land. which is pretty amazing, and that's going to come up in today's lesson a little bit too. And so they get all the way across, and what do the Egyptians do? Yeah, what's good for them is good for us. So they get out there in that gap between the walls of water. Remember how deep the water is? At least it would be today. We don't know that there haven't been some changes in the time, but how deep would it be today at the deepest point if you were crossing on the, what's that? About a half mile, about 2,800 feet, which is a little over a half mile deep. So the Egyptians head out in there, and how does that go for them? What's that?
It doesn't.
So what happens?
The walls of water come back in and all of them are
filled. Yeah, but there's something that happens first, which is kind of interesting.
Wheels fall off.
Well, the wheels start swerving on the chariots. They kind of seem to just go everywhere, have a mind of their own. Reminds me, I had a trailer one time with some wheel bearing that went out. And the trailer was still tracking pretty good, but I look back and one wheel's doing like this. And I'm like, oh, we're going to have to deal with that. It was fine going down the highway, but when I slowed down, because the gyroscopic action of that wheel would keep it stable, but when you slow down, no gyroscopic action, and oh, that was bad. But anyway, their wheels are, they can't steer them. The wheels are swerving, and they just can't make it all work. What is the conclusion of the Egyptians? Do you remember? Their wheels are swerving.
The Lord is
fighting for the Israelites. What action did they attempt to take? They turned around. Let's get out of here. This isn't going to work. They've got a little bit of experience with the power of God back in Egypt, haven't they? Which, by the way, so do the Israelites, but they forget pretty quick. But anyway, so they turn around to flee, and then God says what to Moses? Put your staff back up, and the waters cover up these Egyptians, and they are covered up. How many escaped? None. And so that takes us to chapter 15. Here are the Israelites. They have crossed the Red Sea. Almost certainly they're at the Gulf of Aqaba with the beachhead at Nuweiba. The modern town Nuweiba is there. And they're on the other side and they've seen what God has done. And every front, the water, the wind, that was probably helped pushing them through, the crossing on dry ground. They're on the other side safe, and the entire Egyptian army is gone, dead, and all of their armaments of the day. And so first of all, I'm going to read from Exodus chapter 15. I'm going to read the first 21 verses, and then we'll see if we can get on into the rest of the chapter. Fairly self-explanatory, although we are going to talk about parts of this. So they're across, and this is where it starts. Then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and the rider he's hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will extol him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army, he is cast into the sea, and the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deeps cover them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, is majestic in power. Your right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. And the greatness of your excellence, in the greatness of your excellence, you overthrow those who rise up against you. You send forth your burning anger, and it consumes them as chaff. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters were piled up. The flowing waters stood up like a heap. The deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall be gratified against them. I'll draw out my sword. My hand will destroy them. You blew with your wind. The sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you among the gods, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? You stretched out your right hand. The earth swallowed them. In your loving kindness, you have led the people whom you have redeemed. In your strength, you have guided them to your holy habitation. The peoples have heart. They tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab, trembling, grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them by the greatness of your arm. They are motionless as stone. Until your people pass over, O Lord, until the people pass over whom you have purchased, you will bring them and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord shall reign forever and ever. For the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea on them. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea. Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancing. Miriam answered them, "Sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he has hurled into the sea." So here we see the reaction of the Israelites as led by Moses as they're encamped on the eastern shore of the Gulf of Aqaba. How would you generally describe what you just heard in terms of what's going on with the people? Praising God. Yeah, this is a celebration. This is a time of worship. It says that Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord. So in all probability, this would continue as a song of praise that is brought out to praise what God has done. And so they're proclaiming. They start out in verse 1 that they're singing to God out of worship, and that's prompted by what they have just been through and the observation of his great act. And so here they are, and it's somewhat personal. They're singing in first person in verse 2. I will sing to the Lord. Why? He is highly exalted. The horse and the rider is thrown into the sea. That's repeated a number of times, and of course they see this as the great miracle. Why would this be something that stood out amongst all of this miracle of the Dead Sea crossing? Why would this be so significant to them?
Well, something like that is not possible.
Well, it's not possible.
So it has to come from the Lord.
Yeah, certainly. They're right there.
You're going against the armies of the Pharaoh. These are no mean enemy to scoff at. I mean, you know, this is power personified.
They were the superpower of their day. So when they were encamped at the beach, they had a moment of terror, didn't they? And what prompted the terror?
The armies of Pharaoh.
They knew they were no match. They knew that in a physical way, they were helpless. They had the sea on one hand and the armies of Pharaoh on the other. It's going to be a bloodbath. And it's going to be their blood on the beach. And they know it. And so that was the thing that brought terror. And so God, through this miracle, did a lot of things. He got them across the sea, dry ground, in a place where it could be done, and so on and so on. But the object of terror has been removed. And so there's a certain amount of extra focus on what happened to Pharaoh and his armies. And I said that was verse 2, but then in verse 2, it says, "The Lord is my strength and song. He's become my salvation." They're still recognizing of themselves they had nothing, but here is God himself on their behalf, and he's providing their strength. And so they cry out in these praises. "I'll sing praises to him, my father's God, I will extol him." Well, I said, no, I'm sorry, I skipped a line. "He is my God, and I will praise him." This is somewhat new for the Israelites. Now, we don't know that none of the Israelites looked upon God as their God, but as a group, this is not what they have been saying. For them, it's been all about their comfort, their situation. In Egypt, they were mad at Moses for the miracles sometimes because it caused Pharaoh and his henchmen to further oppress them. And so they're thinking about this in a worldly way. And for the first time, there really is a group saying, "We belong to God. And by the way, my father's God, and I will extol him." This is one of the first times they have looked back and talked about their heritage that came through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and saying, "Yes, he's the God of my fathers, and I'm going to extol him. I'm going to worship him. The Lord is a warrior," in verse 3. "Yahweh is his name, the great I am," which is what Moses was told to bring to them as the name for him. And they go back to what has just happened. This is what went on. Pharaoh and his army, he cast into the sea. The choicest of his officers are drowned. The deeps cover them. They went down to the depths like a stone. And so this is the event they're looking at, and they're bringing it up. And certainly, you know, we have seen, that's a common phrase we have yet today, sank like a stone. And then they go back to God. "Your right hand, O Lord, is majestic in power." And that's a common phraseology to talk about the strength of someone in their right hand. That's the hand of power. And they say it's majestic, it's great, it's beyond description, and it shatters the enemy. "And it's out of the excellence of your greatness that you overthrow those who rise up against you." It's interesting here as they're having this discussion, they are very God-centered discussion, this time of praise. Because they're not talking about, they didn't say, "It's in the greatness of your excellence that you overthrow those who would oppress us." No, no. It's those who rise up against you. They're acknowledging that this is God's will, God's plan, God's doing it, and it is God himself that's being fought against. "You send your forth," in verse 7, "you send forth your burning anger, and it consumes them as chaff." We don't get to see that picture very often today because we don't process our grains like they did then and don't have the chaff that most of us would be familiar with. But that chaff burns very quickly. It's not quite like grain dust, but it burns quickly. And so we get down to verse 8. They say, "At the blast of your nostrils, the waters were piled up. The flowing waters stood up like a heap, and the deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea." So they're describing that parting of the sea that allowed them to cross on dry ground. What does that last line mean? "The deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea," there in verse 8. What are they taking note of? When something congeals, what's an example of something that congeals?
Jello.
Jello goes from being liquid to being hard, or semi-solid in the case of Jello. Most of the things that we would commonly talk about congealing, how about cottage cheese?
Blood.
You know, but when they're done, they're not something we necessarily would want to talk about in a real positive way. Some of us might cottage cheese. I'm not one of you. But here they're talking about the solidification of that ground. You don't have waters recede and then have a nice, quote, dry ground, solid ground to walk on. You wind up in deep mud But no, that ground was instantly brought together as a solid, as dry ground, and they got to walk on it, and they got to see that. I mean, I can only imagine if you were at the front of this column of people headed into this gap that's being created almost as they're walking. That would be an interesting experience, would it not? Oh, how's this going to work? And so on. And they had to be somewhat shocked even at how well that came about. And clearly God's at work. They get into the minds of the enemy. The enemy said, I'm going to pursue, I'm going to overtake, I will divide the spoil. They realized that Pharaoh is after them because they were a valued resource. And the armies against them says, my desire shall be gratified against them. I want to harm them. I'll draw my sword and my hand, I'm going to destroy them. And then in verse 10, they return back to how God took care of them. You blew with your wind and the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. And so that's just amazing. Who is like you among the gods, O Lord? This is a question. What answer do they expect to this question? Who is like you, O God?
Nobody.
This is a rhetorical question. The answer is assumed to be, by asking the question this way, there is nobody like you. Who is like you, majestic in holiness? His holiness, by the way, what's that word holiness mean?
Pure.
Without sin.
Perfect.
Perfect. Faultless. I mean, honestly, in English and any language, we run out of words because God is the definition of holiness. There is a goodness and a greatness to God that is beyond our comprehension. But they're saying your holiness is majestic. It's obvious. It's big. It's huge. It's awesome in praises, working wonders. You stretched out your right hand in verse 12, and the earth swallowed them. And verse 13, I think, is something very important that they were thinking about. In your loving kindness, what does that mean? These aren't hard questions.
Mercy.
What? This goes at God's motive, right? In your loving kindness, they're talking to God. And what is loving kindness? It certainly includes mercy.
Love.
It's a care for someone else, right? In your care for us, in your loving kind mercy, you have led the people whom you have redeemed. This is significant wording for what they're saying. In terms of their own identity, in terms of who God is, and what their relationship with God is. God, you dealt with us with love. It was kind. You showed your power, and out of your loving kindness, you showed your power, and you led us. People you have redeemed. Can we describe what that means, that they have been redeemed? You saved him. Ransom paid. What?
Set aside for him.
Yeah, when we get to the New Testament, we're going to understand redeemed in a whole new way. We were slaves to sin, right? And we are redeemed. We are bought out of that slavery. We are bought by Christ as slaves, and then we become his slaves. Now, the good news for us doesn't end there. He doesn't just purchase out of that slavery to take us out of that oppressive slavery to sin, but then sanctification begins, and eventually we become heirs, joint heirs, brothers, grafted in with Christ. And so it's a starting point, but it grows from there. Here they say, you redeemed us in the sense that, were they slaves?
Yeah.
Did God get them out of their slavery? Yeah, how did he pay the price to get them out of their slavery? Well, he exacted the price on the Egyptians. to the point that the Egyptians wanted them to go. And they wanted them to go so bad, what did they do?
Gave them all their riches.
Piled the goods on them and told them, get away before we're all dead. Now the Egyptians kind of forgot that after a while. We studied that last week. They regretted losing all that big labor force, and so they went after it, thought they had the power to do it. They kind of were poor in memory, weren't they? I mean, they just got through losing all their firstborn and all the other plagues they'd been through. Why would you change your mind and want them back? But anyway, they did. And verse 13, in your strength, you have guided them to your holy habitation. What are they thinking about here?
Well, they had to have been very humble to realize all the complaining that they did originally, and all of a sudden now, that same person that we were, you know, mad at, now he is saving us.
Okay.
No matter what we have done.
Okay. So they're acknowledging God's strength,
right.
And you have guided them, us, the ones you redeemed, you, God, guided to your holy habitation. What's the holy habitation?
The promised land.
Yes. All of a sudden, they're thinking about promised land. They're reviving the promises made to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob about getting the whole land that we would have said was the Canaanite area. And so they're thinking about, oh, God's going to live there with, he's going to be with us. We're going to habitate together. We're going to dwell together. Our living there will be shared with God. And in verse 14, it becomes very interesting. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of the Philistia. So they say these people have heard, and they certainly will hear. We know if we went ahead and looked in the book of Joshua at the conquest of Jericho, the people in Jericho were scared to death. Why? They've heard about these things, this one in particular. And so anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Who are the ones in Philistia? The Philistines. And where? So when we think of the Philistines, where are they?
They kind of reside on the coastal plain.
Yes.
What is now Judea?
Yeah. Yeah, of what is now Judea. Matter of fact, Gaza.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty much where they were. They were in the southwest corner of what would become Israel. What is Israel today? And so they're if you remember, God said, we're not going by the way of the Philistines. That would have been straight up into Canaanite. We're going over here, which lined up with what God told Moses, that he gave him as a sign, is that you're going to lead the people back to this holy mountain, meaning Mount Sinai or Horeb or the mountain of God. And so they talk about the Philistines, the ones of Philistia, because they are all of a sudden putting their focus on, well, God's taken us where these peoples are. And he says, then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. What are we talking about here? Who are the chiefs of Edom? I'm stretching you back to Genesis.
Weren't they Esau's descendants?
Esau's descendants. And when God took Esau out of the house of Abraham and sent him away with his mother, what did he tell her about what was to come out of Esau's lineage? A nation of people, but specifically 10 chiefs are going to come out of you, and they list them and they talk about them. And so now those descendants of those people, it's been several hundred years, and are there, and they're going back to the chiefs of their step lineage, if you can. Abraham was their father, but they were not the children of the promise. And so they're in the way. Esau settled south of what would become Israel, and a little bit to the east even. And they're going to be one of the first ones that they have to deal with. One of, not the first, but one of the first that they have to deal with. And of course, is there still some jealousy between the Edomites and the Israelites at this point? Yes, and it's never ended. Arabs and Jews. Now that's in a broader sense, but so the chiefs of Edom are going to be dismayed. They're going to see how you are working in the power. Your power is at work with the Israelite nation, and so they're going to be dismayed. The leaders of Moab, trembling grips them. Well, who are the Moabites? There was another whole group that came out of Abraham's clan.
Laban's descendants.
What's that?
Laban's descendants.
No. Close.
Lot's
descendants.
Yeah.
The Moabites are the descendants of Abraham's nephew, Lot. And so, you know, they got ran out of Sodom and Gomorrah, wound up in the hills, not a great start, sinful situation that started that whole clan. But the Moabite people then, the descendants of Lot who are going to be out there, see, we still haven't talked about the people who were more or less native to the Canaanite region. We're talking about all the people that had Abraham as at least a relative, if not their ancestor. And they're going, all these people are going to be concerned because, see, we're distinguishing between the children of the promise and the other descendants of Abraham or relatives of Abraham. And then in the last part of 15, we get to the Canaanites. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Now, they don't mean they're gone or they left. What he means is they just kind of collapse in on themselves in fear. This is about their fear of the children of the promise. And those people knew the promise that Abraham's offspring would come and inhabit the lands of Canaan. And so now here's the children of promise. God's exercising power with them. And so the result in verse 16, terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of your arm, they are motionless as stone. Every once in a while, one of these videos goes out, and I watched one a while back about a dog at the vet. I've never seen anything quite like this, but I've seen some things similar. This dog was terrified. It was up on the treatment table, and he turned his head a little bit and raised one paw and froze. That he wasn't moving anything. I don't know if he thought he could be still enough that the vet would forget he was there. I don't know, but this dog was motionless as stone. As a matter of fact, I watched for a while because I'm going, no, they just tuck a stuffed dog up there and they're trying to fool me. But no. Eventually the dog couldn't hold it forever. So they are motionless as stone until your people pass over, O Lord, until the people get there. They're locked up with fear. Until the people pass over whom you have purchased. They get it. They belong to God. They're his. And God is directing them. God is leading them. God is their power. They get it all. And in verse 17, they say, this is what you're going to do. You will bring them and plant them in their mountain of your inheritance. The place, O Lord, which you have made for your dwelling. The sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord shall reign forever and ever. So they're looking for their time in the land of Canaan to be a long-term, lasting relationship with God where they're going to live forever and ever. They say in verse 19, for the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea on them. But the sons of Israel walked through on dry land through the midst of the sea. They're focused on this miracle. And they see their relationship with God in the way that they've expressed it here, anticipating that they're going to go forward to this land and have this kind of a relationship with God permanently. And then Miriam brings the women into the celebration. Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancing. And she said, sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and the rider he's hurled into the sea. So the theme continues. They're looking at the destruction of Pharaoh. Now, it's interesting. What was Miriam, what's the timbrel? Yeah, pretty much tambourine. That's what we think. And it's interesting, the title that she gets is Miriam the prophetess in verse 20. Let's go back and look at Exodus 2, 1 through 4. Exodus 2, 1 through 4. Moses is a baby. The decree is out. The decree is that the midwives will see that all the baby boys are put to death in the Israelite births. And this is what we see here about Moses. Now, a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. My daughter's dealing with a newborn this week. That would be a job. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. She put the child in and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Is this Miriam? Well, there's a good chance of it. We don't know how many sisters he might have had, but this is the only one mentioned in the scriptures. And so this sister in Exodus 2 played a role of helping get Moses into the house of Pharaoh through Pharaoh's daughter and so on. But it's interesting here that we find out that they call her a prophetess. This is the first prophetess mentioned in the Bible. The word isn't used before. But turn over to Micah chapter 6. If you've got a John MacArthur New American Standard Bible, I can tell you it's going to be page 1276. If you don't, then we're back there in some of the later books. It's not real big. And it's right past Joel. I think it's the next book back or something like that. Oh, what's that? Is it Jonah right before? Okay. So it's back there toward the back. Give you a minute or two to find it. We're going to be looking at chapter 6. And just to emphasize that this wasn't something that they just made up, we have God in Micah here is indicting the people. And in chapter 6, he's giving them what the Lord is saying, that they, that God has a case against them, there's a dispute, and the people are saying, what have I done and how have I wearied you? I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I ransomed you from the house of slavery. My people remember Balak, king of Moab, and his counsel, and so on. We get down to verse 6. I want verse 4. Indeed, I brought you up from the land of Egypt and ransomed you from the house of slavery, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. And so this is the first time in Exodus that we see Miriam called out as one that God sent to help lead the people out of Egypt. But Miriam indeed had a role along with Aaron and Moses. And of course, Moses had the main role. He was the prophet God sent to take them out. It was his job to do that and to lead in that way. Aaron was sent to help because Moses lacked confidence in his ability to speak. Aaron's going to become the one from which the high priests are found. And Miriam, of course, then plays a role too. And as we travel through Exodus, we're going to see more of that. So this is their great moment of praise. This is who we are. This is who God is. And we're all together and we trust him. He's wonderful. And he shows us loving kindness, and his great might is expended in order to keep us together and to keep us safe as his chosen people to be taken into Canaan. Any questions or comments so far? Okay, so now let's go ahead and look at the rest of the chapter. The Lord provides water, starting in verse 22 in Exodus 15. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and regulations, and there he tested them. And he said, "If you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer." Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they camped there beside the waters. So we're starting to see the trek from the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba over toward Mount Sinai. And so it says here that Moses led Israel from the Red Sea. Now, let's not forget, there's a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire still going with them. The scriptures were very clear, those were not removed. So they move from the Red Sea to the wilderness of Shur, and they go 3 days without water. So 3 days after they sang that great song, they come to Marah. It wasn't named Marah then, but they named it Marah because the waters were bitter. They were not drinkable, and that's what the word Marah means, is bitter. And so what did the people do when they got to this poor water? What happened to the song? How long did it take?
3 days.
3 days. God, your loving kindness, your great might and power. You're just amazing, God. Where's my water? 3 days later. What did Moses do?
Cried after the Lord.
Yeah. And I don't want to say that's bad for sure, because who should you be talking to at that point? They looked at Moses and said, "What are we going to do? What are we going to drink? How are we going to survive? If he can pile water up a half mile high, he can get you a drink. Just calm down," would be a good answer. But God is where Moses turns to. He cried out. That's not necessarily bad language. What did the Lord do? See this tree here? And Moses then got the message. He threw it into the water. And what happened to the water? Was this a miracle? Or was this just chemistry?
It's a miracle.
Absolutely. There is no tree known that you can throw in bitter water and it'll make it sweet. And certainly not in the time element that we're talking here. And so it became sweet. And in verse 25 then, God says, "Okay, you need to pay attention." He says, there he made for them, this is the last part of 25, a statute and regulation, rules. And he tested them. What was the test?
"Do you trust me?"
Do you trust me? How did he test them?
"Listen to me."
Well, back up a little bit. What did they just do? They marched 3 days without water. Let's see how they react when things don't go just the way they wanted them to go. Who's in charge? God is. They affirmed that in chapter 15. "You're God. You redeemed us. You own us. We're your slaves. What do you want us to do? Oh, and we know you're going to take us up to the promised land because you declared that through Abraham. So we're yours, and you're going to..." But they had in their mind what it would look like to be the people of God as descendants of Abraham. And once they got through this trial of the Egyptians chasing them, they thought they had a God that was going to pave them a road and destroy all the armies without them having to be very involved, or without them enduring hardship, without sacrifice. And so he tested them, marched them 3 days, right to water, didn't find it for a while, but when they get to water, it's no good. And they failed the test. Moses, what are you doing? How'd we get here? What's going on? And so God said, all right, there are regulations and statutes, and I've tested you. In verse 26, he says, if you will give earnest heed to the voice of your God, voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer. So is God going to continue to give them more statutes and regulations? Yeah, but this is the starting point that's specific to this group of people traveling across the land through the wilderness, starting with the wilderness of Shur, that you need to give earnest heed. What does that mean? Earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God.
Pay close attention.
Pay close attention. There's something tied up in that word earnest that we need to understand. Well, obey. Can you have obedience that's not earnest? Huh? No? Well, I think you can. I supervise too many people too long. You can have people do exactly what you tell them, but it's not coming with agreement that it's even an intelligent thing to do, let alone something that they are doing because they know it's what the team needs to do, or a potentially good path. Yep, you're stupid, boss, but I'll do it if you say so. And people can start to focus on the external part of following rules. But God doesn't say here, if you do what I say. He says, if you give earnest heed, if you go, you are God, I trust you, God, and if you told me to do it, I'm going to do it from the heart. That's what he's asking for here. You align your being with following me. And if you do the things I ask you to, if you give heed to the voice, my voice, the voice of the Lord your God, Yahweh, do what is right in his sight, give ear to the commandments and keep all his statutes earnestly, then I'm going to do something. And what does he say he's going to do? Or in this case, not do? Look at those words there in verse 26. What in the world? He said, I'm not going to put the diseases on you I put on the Egyptians. Where's that coming from?
Judgment.
And it should be very real to them. They saw the 10 plagues, right? What was the last, quote, disease?
Kill all the firstborn.
Man and animal. Hit the flocks and hit the families. And there were other diseases along the way and other calamities. And God is saying, if we turn it around, if you don't, from your heart, obey what I ask you to, then you can expect similar judgment to what I gave to the Egyptians. By the way, how did the Egyptians do in battle?
Well, they all died.
They were drowned in the sea. well, they realized they were fighting God. I mean, the Egyptians realized they were fighting God. The Israelites didn't even have to fight with them. But God said, I don't need a foreign army to take you out. I just need a little water. Or a lot of water. God can do it. And so he gave them this statute and regulation, and he tested them. And how did they do? Not well. They did not remember the words that they had proclaimed to God 3 days before as they looked back on this sea that they had crossed on dry ground. And God said, this is who I am at the end of verse 26. I'm not going to put those diseases on you like I put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer. I'm the one that gives you strength. I'm the one that takes care of your problems. I'm the one that's going to lead you through this. And when you're ill, I'm going to heal you, unless it's my judgment that I'm giving to you. And there will be some judgment before we're done with our trek toward Israel. And so God is saying, I'm your healer. Don't get it backwards. I can also be your adversary if that's the path you take. And I think toward verse 27 is just wonderful. God says, all right, this is the role I'm going to play. I'm going to be great within you. You've got to be my people earnestly following me, obeying me. Which, by the way, are they going to do that? Could they have possibly done that? When we look at the New Testament, it's very clear that the rules that God gives them are part of training mankind. You don't have what it takes to be righteous and holy. You need more than that. And God, through his grace and his spirit, saves many from the Old Testament through faith, not through success in meeting all of his law, but it's also the beginning of showing that mankind cannot be saved apart from what Christ does on the cross. But I like verse 27, because after God says, I'm your healer, what does he do? He leads them to Elim. In Elim, there are 12 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they camp beside the waters. This is how I will take care of you. The whole picture. I may lead you for several days without water till you feel desperate. Ultimately, I'm going to take care of you. And he gives them this wonderful place of springs and camping with date palms. And it was just a wonderful place to be. What they needed was there. Questions, comments, thoughts? By the way, it's not there anymore, so don't go driving and try to find it. But I feel like I have experienced a little bit of what it was like to get to these springs. I grew up south of the Kansas River, across the river from a little town, Berg, called St. George. And there's a high school now north of there, up at a place called Flush. But in the days when I was a kid, they had a horse trough out in front of one of the stores. I don't remember enough about it, but they had this pipe that came out of the ground, no pumps involved, and they piped it out so it fed into this horse tank. And then you could bring your own cup, or if you wanted, were brave, they had a community cup there, and you could taste that spring water. It was spring water. When they put in the water district up there, they intentionally drilled where they thought they could hit those springs, and they did. And when they sent the water in for testing to the state said, this water is as perfect as it could be for human consumption. But by law, you have to chlorinate it. So now when it goes out in the pipes for all the consumers, it gets chlorinated. And the horse tank and that pipe is gone. But when I was with my grandparents and we were traveling, we had to go several miles out of our way, but we would, because Highway 24, old 24, went through St. George and back in the 40s somewhere, probably long before I was alive. They built a new highway and it no longer went through St. George, but we'd go out of our way to go drink that spring water, and I'm telling you, there was nothing like it. And I kind of imagine that that's what these people experienced when they got to that spring water there at Elim. They were probably, wow, this is good. Now, I'm projecting. I don't know if that's what they really thought or if it was really that great. But I've had good spring water, and you cannot beat it. Any questions, comments? I've got a thought for you. I am certain that God has done some wonderful things in your life. How long does it take for me, I'll just talk about me, to forget who God is that I serve and how he's taken care of me? And when things start to come apart, I feel like, oh, I mismanaged. I got to get this fixed. What am I going to do? Disaster is here. Only took them 3 days, and they had bigger miracles that they could see, at least with their eyes, than I've ever had. And I don't think it takes me 3 days. I think I can do it in a second. Go right from what a gracious God I serve to how in the world am I going to endure this? It's the wrong question. I shouldn't even be asking me questions. Or even the people around me. Now, there's nothing wrong with going and getting some godly advice and some godly inputs. But certainly what I need to be doing is praying to God, saying, God, I don't know what you're doing here. I don't know how to handle it, so you're going to have to lead me. But I trust you to take me where you want me to go. And I think it also relates well to Hebrews 11. Constantly, when it talked about the people of faith, they did not consider themselves as residents of earth. They were not people of the world. They went about as foreigners, as sojourners, as strangers, non-citizens of earth, because they were citizens of heaven. They didn't even get their earthly promises fulfilled, but instead looked forward with greater anticipation to what would come to them in their eternal life. And it's so easy to get caught up with a focus on this earthly world and the real-time, current-day consequences and events, sometimes of my own sin, sometimes just the way life goes. Sometimes God puts us in very, very difficult situations because he has a purpose in our life. Now, in this case, God had foretold through Abraham that he would bring them out of Egypt and would bring the offspring of Abraham as a nation of great number to the land of Canaan and establish them as a nation in that land. So it wouldn't have been possible because of God's projected plans that he had announced to Abraham. But even if it had been God's plan to bring them across the sea and then they were to die in a difficult situation, if it fit God's purpose, we should be willing to endure that. It isn't just always how God leads us through living that sees God's purpose is done. It also can be how God leads us through oppression, slavery, and death itself. So we've got to watch out putting our parameters on top of what it means for God to care for us and lead us and take us through the events of life. If we really want God glorified, then we want God glorified even if it means very difficult things for us. So I'll leave you with that thought. We'll see you next week.